Podcast meeting brilliant minds and looking at the world around them. How do they 360 themselves and 360 the world? Jamie Neal, the host, asks many questions about their mindset and how they fundamentally operate their world and the world around them. Hello and welcome back to 360 Yourself. I hope you're having a magical day. It is sunny. I'm in Devon and it looks like we're going to have sun for the next 10 days. So I have a brilliant guest with me today. I have Lucy Anderson. Hello, Lucy. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm really good, thanks. How are you?
Very, very good. So whereabouts are you talking from today?
So I've come back home to my family home that I grew up in. So I'm in Chichester in West Sussex, along the south coast.
So did you go to Chichester theatre a lot then when you were younger?
Yeah, I did. I mean, to have a theatre like that on your doorstep is amazing because they get a lot of kind of transfers that then go to the West End. So it'd be like you'd get a sneak peek before they'd move, which was always really cool. And I did the youth theatre there for 3 years, I think I did it.
Really
cool theatre.
Is there a little tiny bit ambition in you that wants to go and perform on that stage? Because that was kind of your local thing that you grew up watching.
Oh my God, totally. The summer musicals that they get in are always epic, but they also get really good plays in the Minerva. So you've got the main Chichester Festival Theatre, and then you've got the smaller stage, which is called the Minerva. And some of the plays that I've seen in there are just phenomenal. So I think either do one of the summer musicals or to do a play in the Minerva would be absolute goals. It'd just be cool to go back.
It would be, wouldn't it? I mean, of course, when this is over, we'll have to go back to the theatre life. But obviously, major theatres like Chichester Theatre, kind of like the Curve Theatre, all the kind of big regional theatres, I think will be absolutely fine. Because there's a lot of kind of like how they're going to finance and all that sort of thing. But I think the bigger kind of regional, like and Sheffield and all that sort of thing, I think they'll be fine. So your ambition will still be able to complete for 2021-2022.
Yes, hopefully. They've got, I think Chichester have got an amazing kind of support network in terms of the people that go, and you know, there are some very passionate people in Chichester about the theatre who I'm sure will keep it going, you know, if nothing else.
Yeah, it's the same thing for me. I live in Plymouth. Well, I'm from Plymouth, and we got a big theatre here called Plymouth Theatre Royal, and it is so celebrated in my community within Plymouth. Like everyone goes to the theatre. Like it's just a lot of tours start here and then they work their way up. But it's the same thing as well. Like they will have the support from the community because everyone literally goes to the theatre. Everyone's quite educated here with theatre. Like not the kind of like very, what's the word? Not the kind of like very narrative stuff. It's all very like big musicals. Big musicals really work down here and people are really educated to that. But I think if they saw Equus, I don't think that really worked down in Plymouth. Even though it's a great show, but they love Hairspray, they love like Jersey Boys and that sort of thing. Everyone goes to those shows, so they make a lot of money in Plymouth.
Yeah, that's it's similar to Chichester actually, because I feel like the musicals that tend to be a real hit are things like Carousel, Oklahoma, kind of the more classic musicals. And I remember a while ago saying, oh, you know, we've actually had sort of similar musicals coming in for quite a while. I wonder, you know, if they're going to be bringing in something new and something different. And then I saw that Six, the tour, was going to go to Chichester. And I went, oh, now that's interesting. Because Six is so different to sort of stuff that they would usually put on. But they had such a boost of like sort of 18 to 25s coming into the theatre to come and see that show. that I was like, yes, Chichester, because it just meant that they were sort of bringing in everything to suit everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was really cool. I thought it was great when I saw that they were bringing that in. As I say, I don't know if it went down that well with some people. I mean, I was doing Dear Evan Hansen at the time, so I couldn't go and see it in Chichester. Seen it in London, but I couldn't sort of go and see the reaction of some of the Chichester residents. But yeah. I just think it was wicked that it went there.
Because majority of people are like the older generation, but I guess the artistic director, I think, is it Daniel?
Daniel Evans
is the artistic director. And maybe he's like he's looking forward and going, when these older generation go, we've got to make sure that we have the youth who are there.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you've got the university there that, you know, you do have sort of a lot of 18 to 25 year olds, and they've got this great, I don't know what you'd call it, whether you'd call it a system or a program. It's called the Prologue
mm-hmm.
system, which is, it's like a ticketing thing where if you're aged 18 to 25 or 26 or something, you can get tickets for a fiver.
Oh, wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, they go like wildfire.
I can imagine £5 tickets.
Yeah, but because I was actually working front of house there, I feel like I've done every possible role at that theatre.
So you just need to get on stage now, basically. You just need to be a leading lady on the stage and you're done.
Exactly. I've just got one more box to tick. Yeah, I was doing front of house when he came in as artistic director, and he just had like a coffee morning with everyone. And, you know, he didn't sort of do a massive speech or anything like that. He literally was just like, hi, guys. I'm gonna do some stuff, hope you enjoy it, and it's great to meet you all. And he was just a really chill guy and was really nice, so I think he's worked really hard, and the theatre's always been great there, but he's definitely stepping it up a notch, I think.
Yeah, it's like Nikolai Foster when he took over Curve Theatre, same thing. I mean, Curve was doing really, really well with Paul Kerrison, but then I think Nikolai took it to the next level, and then everyone's like, oh my god, Curve Theatre, I really want to work there. So what I want to know is, so obviously you are in Dear Evan Hansen, but I want to know, way before that, how did you get into it? What is your upbringing? How did you get so passionate about the theatre and the creative arts?
Yeah, so I choked on some water just before this, and it sucks up. Sorry, excuse me. I probably didn't sort of look at theatre as a career seriously until I was maybe about 16.
Mm-hmm.
I'd kind of done it at high school, but, you know, I sort of did GCSE drama and I did a bit of dance, and I was always sort of told, you know, you're quite good at drama, and I was like, oh, wicked.
Fine.
And just sort of brushed it off, because I don't think I saw it as something serious. I think I very much had a mindset of, oh, you know, I need to do something that's going to be stable and that kind of thing. And I'd gone to college. I didn't stay at the sixth form that I went to high school at. I went to a different college just to sort of have just a new place, meet new people or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing subjects to suit nursing, because I was going to apply to be a paediatric nurse, which is obviously so different to acting.
Yeah.
So that was kind of what my aim was. And I was doing like science-based subjects and stuff like that. I still had drama in there, so there was obviously a part of me that couldn't quite let it go. But everything else was all like science and English and communication and all that kind of stuff. It was sort of towards the beginning of my first year of college. I was quite badly bullied at college, and was really struggling, I was just kind of struggling to stay in college, I guess, as in mentally stay engaged and stuff like that. And my best friend Alice, who was at a full-time performing arts school, so she was kind of going full throttle, you know, theatre, and she gave me the phone number for her singing teacher, and was like, this is her phone number, because I always loved singing. I mean, my mum, I never slept very well as a child, and it's because I would just be lying there just belting out just these songs, and I'd then hear a knock on the door of my mum just going, Lucy, because it's like midnight or something.
I just have this imagination of like you singing on my own, like in your bed, like on my own.
Honestly, I would just lie there completely flat on my back and just let it all out.
Right, okay.
It is funny when I think back. So I've always enjoyed singing, and she gave me her phone number, and she went, look, here's her phone number. Even if you're not wanting to do it as a career, just have it.
Yeah.
And I spoke to my mum, and she was very, well, my mum and my dad, they were both just saying, you know, because you're struggling so much at college, maybe it would be quite nice to do something.
As a confidence boost as well.
Yeah, and just do something that is entirely yours.
Mm.
You know, you don't have to tell anyone you're doing singing lessons if you don't want to for whatever reason. She's going, it is entirely something that is your own that you can just focus on and just have fun. Just have an hour away from everything and just do something that you enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And it really kind of clicked with me because I started having singing lessons with her, and her name's Jane. She's an absolute legend. And she was like, okay, so like, why are you wanting singing lessons? And so I explained everything, and I said, oh, you know, I've never sort of had singing lessons. I've always sang, but have never looked at it from a technical point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And she went, okay, so are you auditioning for drama schools? And I went, oh, no, I've never really thought about it. I'm applying for nursing. And she just went, okay. As if there was a part of her brain that went, you're not going to go and do nursing. And I sort of did musical theatre singing exams, and that was kind of when I started to take it a bit more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I applied to do nursing, and I got in to do nursing.
Mm-hmm.
But I always knew that I was going to take a gap year anyway.
Mm-hmm.
My mum is cabin crew, and my brother went travelling on a gap year as well. So I just kind of wanted to do the same thing. I thought, before I have to, you know, knuckle down and get on with life, I want to go off and travel and do that kind of thing. So I just decided, I deferred my entry for uni. So I got the place, but I just postponed it by a year. And I went off and did like volunteer work and all of this. And I just decided, I went, oh, well, you know, I've got the year off. I'll go to a couple of auditions. Like,
yeah, and just and see what happens. Yeah, see what happens. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was so weird actually, because the only places that I auditioned for the first time were GSA and Mount View. That was it. And I'd got one for Mount View, and I did it before I went travelling. And then I was told that I had applied for GSA too late. So I thought, oh, okay, it's all right, I'll brush it off. And then I was doing an 8-week sort of volunteer programme in India. And I was about 6 weeks in, and my mum rang and was like, hi, Lucy. So GSA have rang, and because they've had so many applicants, they've actually added another audition day.
Oh.
So they've obviously gone through people that they've had to reject because they were too late or something.
Yeah.
Or they had too many. I can't fully remember why, but they obviously just came back and they rang my mum, and my mum went, oh, she's actually in India at the moment. So it's a little bit awkward. So my mum just rang me, and she went, look, it's entirely your decision. It's in a week's time, I think. And of course, I wasn't prepared in any way because...
You're in India.
I'm in India. So I was like, oh, God. And because obviously very lucky having a mum who is cabin crew, she was like, I can change your flights quite easily if you want me to. So if you want me to change your flight and you want to come for the audition, I can do it. So I had to think about it. And I thought it actually kind of slotted in quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Because India was getting very hot. It was heading into full blown,
right, okay,
like almost 50 degree heat. So I thought, oh, it's starting to get very hot. I feel like I've had really good chunk of time because I was working as like a solo volunteer, so I wasn't with anyone else.
Uh-huh.
So I was working in a school, and I was like, actually, I feel like I've done a really good chunk of time with this school, that I feel like 2 weeks there probably isn't much more I can give than I've already given.
Mm-hmm.
So why not actually just take the chance to go and audition, see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I got all the way through and got onto the reserve list, didn't get in, but it just gave me such a kick up the bum, and I just turned to my mum and went, well, I was crying at the time, because I was like, Mum, I think I want to audition for drama school, but it's really scary, and all of this kind of thing. And my parents were amazing, and they just said, if that's what you want to do, go for it, because I think if you were to go and do nursing, which I'm sure I would enjoy, I think I'd love to do nursing, but they were saying, if you don't at least try, then you're never going to know.
Exactly, exactly that. Wise parents.
Yeah, I know, they are, they're amazing. And and that was basically how I sort of stumbled my way into it, I think. I had a few bumps in the road of kind of self-doubt and, you know, lack of confidence and that kind of thing. But, it just sort of happened. And it took me 2 years to audition. And then I did an Easter course at GSA.
Uh-huh.
Because my mum, bless her, when she knew that this is what I wanted to do, she was like, right, we need to get you into dance classes. We need to...
Yeah, military plan. Kind of
yeah, because my dance, oh my God, I can't even tell you, was I had two left feet completely. Like, I could get by, but my mum, like, she always says that she is my biggest supporter, but she'll also be my biggest...
Critique. Yeah.
You know. Yeah, which is what you need. You need someone that's your number one cheerleader, but they'll also go, Lucy, that wasn't good. and she said, she was going, you know, if you want to do it seriously, because it was me that was feeding back to her going, I think it's my dance that's letting me down.
Yeah.
So she was going, okay, well, we'll try and give that a boost. And so she really kind of was such a push in helping me trying to get towards what I wanted and sort of tackling the areas that I was struggling in. So we'd seen, there was like a 3-day Easter course at GSA, which was kind of just musical theatre. You would cover all three disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
And I got chatting to the staff members that were running it, also ran the foundation course. And I was chatting to a guy called Nick, who was involved in the foundation course. And he was going, yeah, you know, we've got some auditions next week. You should come. So... And I'd never considered a foundation course at all. I was kind of always just gunning for the 3-year. I went, oh, okay. So went along, loved the audition, really nice panel. It was all sort of the teaching staff that would be teaching us on the course, and they were lovely. And got a place on the foundation course, had an amazing year. It was such a great year. And then got into Mount View in my third year of auditioning, but I definitely don't feel like I would have got into a 3-year course without the foundation course. Kind of for me personally, it was such a big thing for me.
I did that as well. I did 2-year foundation course. I'd auditioned for like since I was 6. I'm the opposite. I knew what I wanted to do when I was 10 years old. I'm like, drama school. But I auditioned for 2 years straight, and then when I was 18, then I auditioned for like 30 schools or whatever, and then got scholarships at lots of different places. But I definitely would not have got all my scholarships without my foundation course. And I'd say to everyone, foundation course is a really great way of developing and nurturing and getting to that next level that you need to just to get in there.
Oh, God, completely. Because I don't think I'd realised actually how far I'd come until we got to the end of the course. Because, I mean, spent 2 years, never got in anywhere. I mean, apart from that reserve that I got from GSA in the first year, I had never got past the first round for other schools. And I was like, oh, I don't know what's going wrong. And then did the foundation course and then got to the end of that. And I had two offers and a scholarship for Mount View. And I thought, well, something's obviously gone well. And I mean, who knows? Sometimes I think it can just be a particular year is your year. And can just sort of happen. And maybe you haven't changed much in the year between auditions, but it just happens to be that that's your year and that's the year group that you fit into.
That happened to me with the college I went to. I went to Rombert, and the first year I auditioned, there was like a ridiculous people that were in my audition, and they all went to like Royal Birmingham Royal Ballet. Some of them did go to Rombert in the end, and I was in this audition going, oh my god, these people, I knew these people and they all were like proper ballet boys, and I was like, oh man, I'm in a really, really difficult audition room. And then a year later, I did another year training, but then I was like the one of the top people in that audition room. But I remember that first time going, like, and everyone was all these royal, and like some people went to like American Ballet Theatre and stuff, and I was like full out. But it's we forget sometimes that sometimes it is the audition room that you're in that year, and it could just be people are just ridiculously amazing.
Yeah, completely. I think, which is because I get a lot of people at stage door that will sort of go, oh, you know, I've got my Mountain View audition, or I've got my Arts Ed audition, or whatever, and have you got any advice? And I always sort of say, because obviously I took a few years to get in. First, I'll always ask them, is it your first year that you're auditioning? And if they say yes, I always say, do not panic if you don't get in the first time. Because, I mean, for me personally, going slightly later was the best thing. Because I think I needed a little bit of life experience before going to drama school.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Some people can go straight in at 18, come out, do very well. Mm. And that's great because that's their journey, but I do just tell them not to panic. And I said sometimes it's not necessarily just down to your talent. It can just be the right person at the right time. Sometimes it can be what time your audition is, you know.
Yes, all
if
this
someone
sort of
on
things.
The panel has had a really terrible morning. And then you come in and you sing a song that they don't like, it can be something so simple as that, which is annoying.
Yeah.
But it happens. I said that sometimes just the way that it goes. I said, so you've just kind of got to keep strong. And if it means that you have to audition again, just go in full force. Like, don't lose your fire or your flame. Like, just keep it going. And eventually your time will come.
Yeah. And your time did come, and you got into the college. And then you obviously got the role in Dear Evan Hansen, which is a brilliant leading role. So, that must have been a whirlwind of experience. I mean, I spoke to Sam Tutty as well and asked his experience about when he had to audition and when he flew over to New York and all that sort of thing. But also, because your role is also very, very deep, and it's very, very emotional, how do you prepare yourself emotionally? And do you, because obviously, you've had such an amazing kind of journey from like traveling the world and meeting people and having life experience. You must also kind of delve into that to kind of funnel into your character and also as well.
Yeah. I mean, sort of, I would say for every other character that I've played, I've been able to relate it to someone or an sort of experience that I've had. Whereas with Zoe, and I suppose this is why I loved her so much, and just really I wanted the part so badly, you know. I acted really cool and like, yeah, you know, if I don't get a recall, whatever, but I was so I just wanted her so badly because I just found her so interesting, because I've never met or spoken to someone that has gone through something that she goes through in this show. This kind of idea that, you know, someone who is your own flesh and blood, like someone who's your own family, has passed away. I'm hoping people that listen to this know the story, because there might be some spoilers. but she really struggles to grieve over him because they didn't get along. You know, I don't want to use the word bully. I don't think he bullied her as such, but he made her life very difficult.
Yeah.
And, you know, being 16 and kind of going, no, I'm not gonna grieve over someone that I didn't like, who I didn't get on with, I think that is such an interesting emotion to play. And I mean, for me personally, I've got two brothers and I love them both immensely, so I couldn't imagine ever feeling that way about my own family.
Yeah.
So it was just something that I kind of, you know, I watched a lot of videos on grief, and, you know, during the audition process when it was, you know, it was starting to get a little bit more intense, and the auditions were actually turning more into like workshops and stuff like that. And I was just trying to find and sort of, yeah, I guess just find clips or stories or blogs or anything of anyone that has kind of been through something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot more than I ever imagined.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just kind of thought this character is, you know, I think she represents an emotion, or she represents something that isn't really ever talked about. Mm. This idea that grief can be difficult when you're not grieving, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, she's got her family around her. You know, she's got Cynthia, her mum, who is absolutely, you know, Lauren, who plays Cynthia. I don't know how she does it. She cries basically throughout this whole show, and I watch her on stage, and I'm like, oh my god, she's so, I can get completely lost in Lauren sometimes, and she kind of really helps me on stage. I feel like we connect quite well on stage together, especially because we don't always get on in the show, the pair of us. We have a few shouting matches.
Mm.
But yeah, I think in terms of finding that emotion, it has been quite a long journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't something that I clicked with straight away. It was something that I had to work for, and as I say, research and really kind of delve into, mm-hmm, in order, mm-hmm, to understand her fully. Because yeah, as much as I loved her, I didn't understand her in, mm-hmm, some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, if I want the audience to understand her, I need to understand her.
Mm-hmm.
And which was basically what I did, and I worked really hard, as I say, to kind of dig into those emotions that she's got.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a thing, you know, all throughout rehearsal. It's something that we all worked on, you know, Michael Grice, the director, and Stephen and Pasek and Paul, you know, we would have talks around the table about all the characters and stuff like that. And it, yeah, so it's been a process, but it, yeah, I think I'm there with her now. I mean, yeah, it took a long time, but once we started getting into, you know, sort of full run-throughs in the rehearsal room and stuff, mm, like that, and I could really link up each scene,
yeah, yeah,
in sequence, that was when the ball really started rolling. And I think it did for everyone. Once we started getting into those full runs, we could then really see the whole journey that these characters are going on.
For sure, yeah.
And, yeah, and then it was all coming together, and then it became the show that it is.
Yeah, so, but how, because obviously you've done so much kind of preparation for it and you've really delved into the character, what I always find with performers is that because you have such a schedule that you have to be in the studio, the theatre, at a certain time, and you're sometimes preparing most of the day for that role in the evening, so your mental state and your physical state has to be really in tune with what you're doing later on. You can't just do anything you want to do. How do you kind of prepare yourself emotionally or just as a person every single day? What is your kind of schedule, and how do you kind of get your mind imbalanced?
Mm. I mean, for me, in terms of mentally preparing, I would say I don't do that much. You know, I don't kind of sit in my room and go, okay, I need to be Zoe now.
I love that.
because I feel like then I would get too deep into it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really emotional show. So I think it's just finding the balance of, yes, being emotionally invested in it, but also going, you know, this is my job. I'm not Zoe, and yeah, that kind of thing, if that makes sense. And I think the big thing for me is that the first few times you see Zoe, like when she meets Evan and stuff like that, she is just kind of being a moody teenager.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I never was a moody teenager. Hopefully my parents can vouch for that. But I feel like I can kind of play that quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of prep for me would come when Sincerely Me is going on, which is just before Requiem.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is kind of, that's when you first see Zoe open up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when I would kind of go back and prepare. There's this little staircase backstage, and you know, Sincerely Me would be going on, which is so like happy, and it's got really like upbeat music and really colourful lights, and yet I'm there on the back of the stairs, like, breathing and sort of having to get into that place.
Yeah.
So I would say for me, yeah, I don't necessarily go, right, I need to be in the right mindset, right from the word go, at the beginning of the show. I kind of find moments when I go, okay, I need to take 2 minutes away here before this bit.
Mm.
And I kind of do it as a process, you could say, throughout the whole show.
Mm.
And I mean, the interval, we really do use it as an interval. Like, that is our moment to all, you know, I mean, like, Nicole that plays Alana, we always go and sit in Bex's dressing room, she plays Heidi, and we do just have a good laugh, because I think you need to. Because I mean, that's what the interval is for, I guess. It kind of just gives us a chance to breathe, you know, a lot has happened in act one.
Mm-hmm.
Just gives us time, have a cup of tea, have a water, do whatever, have a bit of a laugh, but then we go back into game mode as soon as act two comes up. And as I say, I mean, another moment which I'd say, you know, I have to kind of take a few minutes to get into is right before the words fail scene.
Mm-hmm.
That one, and I don't actually say a lot in that scene, but, and I mean, I like Sam, I mean, they all do, Sam, Marcus, David, I've seen Alex do it a little bit in rehearsal as well. They all bring something different to that scene. So most of the time during that scene, I am just watching and I'm listening. But I need to make sure that I'm in the right space to be able to do that, because, you know, like, there are moments on stage sometimes where your mind will wander.
Of course,
you know, it's just, it's human. Like, it happens. You can't be in it 100% all the time. But that is a particular scene where I go, I need to be fully focused on what Evan is saying and what he's singing, because this is a really big turning point for everyone. So yeah, I'd say I've gone off on a tangent a little bit.
It's all right.
But I'd say, in terms of mindset, the moments that I really gear up for would be Requiem and Words Fail, I'd say.
And so when you're not performing, what do you do for your kind of your mind, and how do you kind of calm yourself when you're not in your kind of like performance mode? Like, because I assume when you've had, like, when you were bullied and stuff when you were younger, you must have been, well, you probably are more mentally aware and mindful of you and others around you. So how do you kind of, like, when you're in your down moments, how do you kind of have your kind of, like, calm, and what do you do?
I mean, me personally, I think I've always been a very kind of independent person anyway. And that when I've got things going on, or if I am feeling particularly down or something like that, I tend to just keep myself to myself and focus on just something. I'd say, I mean, the two housemates that I live with, we get so upset, we miss each other all the time in terms of our scheduling and stuff like that. So I do tend to have the day to myself a lot of the time. Love it when they are in, though. It's always such a nice surprise when I come downstairs and they're here and I'm like, guys. I love it. But I think I'm fortunate that I can find, you know, kind of areas of quiet, and I can kind of, you know, sometimes I just do stuff like I'll just sit and watch something on Netflix. Like, it's so simple, but I suppose with me doing stuff like that, it just takes my mind away to something else for a little while.
For sure, yeah.
And I mean, I love reading, which, again, I think it's another thing where you can kind of delve into someone else's story for a little while.
Mm-mm.
And that just relaxes me, I guess.
Yeah.
So I do that a lot. And I mean, as you say, we kind of have the whole day to gear up ready for an evening, unless you've got a matinee day. So I think if and I'll be honest with myself, I think if I'm in a place where I don't feel like I should see anyone, then I won't.
Yeah.
You know, I make plans and I see people and I do stuff like that. But I suppose, as you say, because of earlier experiences, I've realised I don't have to please everyone all the time. And, you know, if I do need to take a day out and it means that I have to reschedule with someone, I'll just be honest with them and I'll say, look, today maybe not looking like it's going to be a good day. I'm really sorry. I just need to take some time out. And then you reschedule. And I mean, I'm lucky I've got loads of really supportive friends and I've got a really supportive network. So people get it and they understand. So yeah, I think it's that. I think just kind of, yeah, being honest with yourself when you do need to give yourself a bit of time and a bit of headspace.
Yeah, it's good because you come across so mindfully aware of yourself and when you need that kind of space. I always think about it as the kind of three, I have that three flags. I have the green flag, amber flag and red flag. And when I kind of get into amber flag, when I feel I'm a bit in limbo before I get to the red bit, which is where you kind of get the negative spiral, I know kind of I've got tools of how to manage it, like whether I go for a run or I read a book or I manage it very well and I'm aware of it. And it seems that you're very aware of it when you're in that space of how to deal with it, how to get you back into that green zone, as it says.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's interesting that you say about the flags, actually, because I've done my younger brother is severely autistic. And so I've done a lot of work with children with autism or, you know, just who are on the spectrum and ADHD. And a lot of the kids that I've worked with use that system because they struggle to understand their own emotions sometimes. And they can get stuck in a bit of a rut and they don't know how to get out with it. And and we would use systems like that where we'd have like red card, amber card, green card. And, you know, if they're getting angry or they're getting upset or agitated, you give them the cards and you just say, look, where do you think you are? What colour do you think you are? And then we can sort it out from there. And if they say, like, yeah, no, I'm a red, I need to be on my own, then we go, okay, that's great. And we deal with it and we process what's going on so that we can then get you back down to a green. And I think that's something that I'm not saying everyone needs to have, you know, coloured cards in their handbag or whatever, but I think, as you say, it's actually quite a nice way to almost visualise it and think, where am I on this scale? And once I've identified that, what can I do about it to get me back on track? And it's, I mean, it's so funny because my boyfriend Charlie, we kind of always had a bit of a long distance relationship, so a lot of it is over the phone and this kind of stuff. And some days I do just go, I'm putting my phone away. I'm not talking to anyone. I'm not going on social media. I'm not doing this. And he's just like, okay. And he's so cool because he totally gets it.
Yeah.
Because I think he knows that I'm able to just go away and deal with it and I'll come back and I'll be absolutely fine.
Yeah, yeah. But I also think for him as well, some people would get offended by that. Like, I've been in situations where you'd be like, you'd say to the kind of person going, I just need a like day by myself, and they get really weird about it and they'd be like, oh, why do you need a day by yourself? Have I done something wrong? It's like, no, it's not you. It's just I need. So he's also slightly more aware of, like, and he's good at interpreting and he's really good at reacting to situations and going, oh, I know it's not me. It's definitely you need it and I'm just going to give you space.
Yeah, I mean, because he makes me laugh because he was like, oh, yeah, if we ever get a house together, he was like, I'll make sure that there's a really nice, stylish cupboard under the stairs that if you ever feel like you need 5 minutes of space, you can have your own little den where you can just go and get your space or whatever. I mean, my mum laughs because she was like, a cupboard? Need a whole room. So, yeah, I mean, he's amazing. He's all, because, I mean, I've always been the, I mean, we've been together for nearly 5 years now, and he's always been very understanding of it. I think at first he thought, okay, this is someone who knows when she needs her space.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of wrapping his head around that. But I mean, as I say, yeah, I know I can always be completely honest with him and go, look, I'm having an off day. I need to, like, just mentally let myself go a little bit and give myself some space. And he's like, yeah, totally fine. And as I say, I think the reason I've been able to do that is because I've got such an amazing supportive network around me that understand, and you can be honest.
Yeah, for sure. And when you, so obviously when you're in those kind of moments of limbo, as they say, how do you, well, one, you obviously you have triggers and you can relate, you can understand them, and then you can use your tools to be able to fix them. When you are operating within your world and you might get a bit of a moment when you're outside and you can't just go, oh, I need to be by myself. How do you sort that out? How do you sort that between like not going too far into the red and just keeping yourself back in the green?
Yeah, I think a lot of it with growing up with someone like my brother and kind of the needs that he has, I have learned to be a very patient person.
Mm-hmm.
So if, say, I'm in a situation where I can't just go off and need to have some time, I'm kind of very good at shutting it away until I can have some time to deal with it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, say like I was having a bit of a bad day, but it was a full day of rehearsal and all this kind of thing. And then we have a press something in the evening where it kind of takes up your whole day. I think I'm quite good at kind of not ignoring it. Like I don't think I would ever ignore it.
Mm.
I just kind of know, okay, now is not a good time to be able to deal with it. So you just need to kind of put on a brave face, go through the motions, you know, give 100% that you can give.
Mm.
And then when you have got that time, take it.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
don't just plow on to the next thing. Like find time. Like I always feel like you were always able to find time at some point, even if it's just, you know, whilst you're taking your makeup off or something like that, just, you know, give yourself some time to chill out where you can.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's what I do. I find little pockets here and there where I can, you know, just process whatever it is that's gone on that's put me in that particular
that
mood.
Space. But and so aside from that, how do you get inspired? That's also what I want to know. How does life inspire you? What do you see when you go out into your world?
I mean, I feel like I'm someone that very much feels the weight of the world on them. Like if I feel like something's going on in the world, I get so upset. Like it will be such little things. Like I watched some documentary the other day. I love elephants. I watched this documentary the other day about just the awfulness that goes on with elephants in terms of their tusks and all this kind of thing. And I felt like it was my problem, as in I personally needed to fix it.
Oh.
and I'm going me from my house in Chichester at the moment in lockdown, as much as I would like to, there's not a lot that I can do. So I feel like when I get like that and when I feel those emotions, it makes me feel more connected to the world, I guess.
Yeah.
And I feel like it means that I take things in. I don't know if that's always necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, because as I say, I think I do sometimes take on other people's emotions, you could say.
Yeah.
But I just use that and I go, no, it's okay to feel those things. It just means that you care and stuff like that. So,
yeah. And it's,
yeah, I guess that...
I said it's neither good or bad, though. I think when people say, like, I'm too emotional, or I'm very sensitive, or I feel too much, or whatever, it's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just that's the way you are. And that's where everyone is, and you have tools to be able to cope with those sort of things. And it's a beautiful thing that you feel that, like, because of the animals and all that sort of thing, you feel like you should help them and sort them out. And I think those sort of people are leaders, because at some point you will do something about it because you feel such passion strongly towards it that you help an organization, you'll set up a charity, because I think you're already worldly experienced anyway by going over to kind of India and doing all that sort of thing. You've already made the first step anyway by initiating, going, oh, I feel this, I'm actually going to make a decision and do it. Where a lot of people, I think, just go, oh, I feel it. But they don't, and then it passes, but they don't do anything about it.
Yeah, because, and I mean, sort of speaking of in India, when I was there, that was the first trip I'd ever done away from home. I was 18, I was by myself, and it was a real culture shock going over to India.
Imagine.
And it was just such an eye-opener in terms of the school that I was working in. It was for children with autism. And they also had quite a large deaf community within sort of where I was. And it was just the most amazing thing, because they, in terms of the teaching staff, they're all volunteers. They don't get paid to work in this school. And the mums of the children, they also attend the school, because equally for them, they're learning how to deal with the needs of their child,
yeah,
because they don't
sure.
have much support anywhere else. And it was such a big thing for me that I was going, you know, this woman is going through the same battles that my parents went through, you know, sort of trying to figure out my brother's behavior and, you know, what things worked best for him, and mm-hmm. and they would give him everything that they've got in order to, you know, make his life the best that it can be.
Mm.
And I'm like, oh my God, these mums, they're exactly, you know, I'm halfway across the world, but these mums are exactly the same, but they don't have the help and support,
the resources,
like
yeah.
what my family had.
Mm.
And so that was a big thing, just seeing a whole different part of the world going, this situation
live.
Is not much different to what I've been through, yet the circumstances around it are completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they were very, very behind in terms of like therapies and stuff that they were doing with them. And I will never forget, and it has always stayed with me, and I think about it a lot actually, is that they had what they called the sensory room, so mm-hmm. like sensory play and stuff like that. And they were just sort of asking, and you know, I'm not an expert at it. The only kind of advice that I can give is stuff that I've done with the kids that I've worked with and therapies that I've seen my brother go through. And they took me into this room and they went, oh, you know, this is what we do for sensory. I was like, okay. And they have this box full of different like sponges and brushes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they took a scouring brush, like a full, you know, like the black ones that you yeah. really used to get in there. They took one of those and they took this boy, he was nonverbal autism, which is the same as my brother. And they took all of his clothes off and they pinned him down to the floor and just started scratching at him with this scouring brush. And I mean, he was so distressed. And I was like, okay. And I sort of said to them, I went, you don't need to do that for sensory play. You know, he's quite distressed. I'm not sure he's enjoying it. And the staff and the mum, they just burst into tears because they were saying, oh, well, we heard that sensory was good. And they were trying so hard because, you know, they'd heard that the sensory play was really good,
yeah.
good for them. But they just didn't have enough guidance yet to know how to kind of do it effectively.
Mm.
And even though it was quite a traumatic scene, they were doing it because they thought they were doing the best thing for him.
Yeah.
And it was just the most heartwarming thing because I went, you can put his clothes back on. And was kind of just explaining, you know, when we go through the world, we tend to feel things with our hands and our feet. And I mean, they were like scrubbing down the side of his stomach or something. I was going, you know, you should focus on those areas. And I just laid out all of the sponges and stuff that they had.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, just let him choose. I said, because they'll all be different. They'll all have different reactions to different sensory things.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up picking like the softest sponge that they had. And I was going, there you go. I was like, now you know what he likes and what he enjoys and all of that. And by the time I left, that was what they were doing with all of the kids. They were just letting them go into the room and just picking their own things. And then they were working on what the children chose.
Because
it was just the best thing to know that I left and had helped, even if it was just the tiniest thing.
Mm.
I was kind of able to do something. And yeah, as I say, when I feel like I'm becoming disconnected from the world and I feel like I need a bit of a reality check, that's always the thing that I go back to.
Mm.
And I think of all of them over there. And I always think, oh my God, what are they doing now? Because I mean, this was 2014 I went. So it was quite a few years ago now.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like the things that we, because we're in such a roller coaster career where like we have such highs mm. and we have such lows. And I have it. I mean, you obviously you're in a constant show, so you're in the kind of thing. I think,
yeah.
Like for me as a freelancer, it's basically like a rollercoaster all the time. So one time I'll be in LA and I'll be doing da da da, and then suddenly I'll be that. And I think when we're in where and obviously with your emotions and who you've got in the audience and that sort of thing, I think we can always kind of like we always experience our kind of own reality or our own universe, but actually what we should be doing is zooming out totally and actually going, yes, we're feeling this at this moment in time, but this is happening over in that world, and actually what we're actually witnessing this moment is actually it's important, but it's not really that important compared to what's actually happening over there. And if you zoom out, then actually you become more, again, the word, more mindful of kind of how you're reacting to situations in your own world and go, actually, this is actually not that big of a deal because that's happening over there. And I think we get so, I don't know, so zoomed in on our own world and our own problems that actually we don't see kind of the bigger picture.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think it's a difficult one because, as you say, with this show in particular, I don't think I realised how important it was to people until I started talking to fans of the show and sort of started getting their reactions, because we get so many messages and letters of people that kind of go, this show has completely saved me. Because it's and I think the show came along at a really good time.
For sure.
Where, you know, mental health was starting to be talked about a lot more. And so people had a show that they could go to and escape for a couple of hours. But in a way, they're not completely escaping because it's very much talking to them about issues that they might be going through.
Yeah.
So I think it's just for a lot of people, they can sit and watch it and go, I completely understand. And I think one of the beauties about the show as well is that, I thought this myself before I really got to see it and I got to read the script. I thought it was very much just aimed at kind of, you know, my generation and below, maybe. But then you've got the parents in the show
who also go through it as well. And you
see stuff. Yeah, you see stuff from their point of view. And I mean, the first song you've got, Has Anybody Got a Map, where they're basically saying, you know, just because I'm a parent doesn't mean I'm perfect.
Yeah.
You know, I've still got battles. And you know, you've got Cynthia and Larry who are trying to deal with things that Connor are going through. And you've got Heidi that's trying to figure out all the things that Evan's going through. And I think it's a great all-round show in a way that I think it actually connects with a lot of people. So I sometimes sit and think about it a lot because I go, you know, I love my job. I love it so much. And as you say, sometimes I sit and go, is it important? You know, am I making a difference in any way by acting? And with this show, I think it's proven that,
yes,
you know, we do. I think we all do because of the response that we get from people. And, you know, it's so different to India and kind of what I did over there. But I still feel like it's just as important, just in a different way.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
So it's just, yeah, I think it's just, you know, you've got two completely different scenarios going on. You know, you've got mums in India that are trying to do sensory care with their autistic kids, and then you've got, you know, like young teenagers that are struggling to fit in, you know, in a very Western country, in a very Western world. And yeah, it's so interesting. I think about it all the time, and fascinating.
It's two
completely different situations but both have an impact.
Yeah, it's about what kind of impact you want to leave on this world and what do you want to leave in this world. And I believe that the work that you're doing is really making an impact into people. Whether some people might see it as just performing and acting, actually leaves such an impact on people, how they come away from the piece of art and go, actually, I've been really affected by it and it's helped me through whatever mental process that they're going through at this moment in time.
Yeah, and I mean, me growing up, you know, as I say, when I was struggling in college and stuff like that, I would sit and watch certain actors and actresses. And if I don't know, like say like if I'd watched a film or something, I'd sit and watch it and go, oh my God, that was like, that's done something to me. And I'd almost kind of then want to watch it again and go through it and go, what is it exactly that has touched me? Was it something that a particular actor did, or was it just the story? And I mean, this is so sad, right? So I had a bit of a thing about Angelina Jolie. When I was like 16, I had posters of her everywhere. I watched her do the film Changeling.
Oh yes.
And I was like, wow. I just thought it was brilliant. And there was this one scene in, I can't remember what film it was that she did, because then I basically just started watching all of her work. And I was like, right, I basically studied her in a way, and studied some of the, I mean, I watched Girl Interrupted, which she got the Oscar for, which is so different to Changeling. And I was like, right, she's done two completely different roles. She's done them both phenomenally. Like, and I would basically just like watch acting techniques. And there was this one scene in something that she did where all she did was lift one eyebrow. And I was like, whoa, she didn't even need to say anything. And then I couldn't lift one eyebrow, and I taught myself to lift one eyebrow. I mean, you think, what was I doing? I think I sellotaped one of my eyebrows down, and I taught myself to lift one eyebrow.
That's
because
brilliant.
I was like, if I can inflict some emotion with just my eyebrow, I mean, why not?
But it's like Ian McKellen, though, when he just looks at you. It's the way he did a talk on, like, just the way that you look at someone. It's the same thing. It's like you don't need to say anything.
Yeah. And so I just remember doing stuff like that, going, wow, that eyebrow really affected me. I want to do that to someone else. what was I going to say? I can't remember. My train of thought has completely left my brain.
It's right. I did the same thing. One of my favorite films is Interstellar. Christopher Nolan, and it's the same thing at the end that I always analyze, because I'm like, I always get upset, I always start crying at the end of it, and it's when he goes, Matthew goes to see his daughter who's dying at the bed, and he says the line, "How'd you know I was going to come back?" And she says, "Because my dad promised me." And I'm like on the floor, like dying. And I'm like, what inflection are you putting on certain words? What is the breath control? Like, I'm really analysing, going, why was it just, is it just the line that I really love? I just think it's just so brilliant.
It is. And I mean, because I'll sit and watch stuff with like old school friends or something who are not involved in acting whatsoever. And even because sometimes I even think it's not necessarily acting. I think sometimes with film or TV, you can have the soundtrack that has been put with it can just completely lift a scene. And I remember going to see something with some friends, and I can't remember what it was, but there was just a really good like harmony between like strings. So whether it was like violins or cellos or something like that. And it just made me really emotional in the scene. And I was like, oh my God, did anyone hear when the strings came in? And they're all going, what?
Because they're not aware.
What are you talking about?
They're just not aware of it. I think you're more of a I think when you're in the arts, you're more heightened aware of like any sort of simple sort of things that emotionally get us going. Because a lot of people don't realise the chemical reaction or the emotion that something can happen because they're not in tune with that side of them, just because they're so oblivious to it. And I think as actors and as performers and as artists, we're so aware of our emotions because that's what we use within our work.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, because I can even relate that back to Dear Evan Hansen in Words Fail. You know, we've been doing the show for a while, and actually I think it was at the beginning of this year, not long before we had to shut because of coronavirus, actually. And some of the American creatives came back over just to kind of check in. And we did a couple more rehearsals, and basically just to check that it was still fresh. And, you know, we hadn't kind of just sat into it, and we hadn't got too comfortable that we were still playing. And we got to Words Fail, and they were saying, oh, hang on a minute, Lucy. When I exit, they went, can you actually do it? They said, there's a particular chord in the music. Can you actually move on that instead of moving before it? And I went, yeah, sure, fine. And, you know, to someone just sat in the audience, they may not even notice that that has changed, or that may not have any impact on them whatsoever. But for whatever reason, the chord is so beautiful that as I was going off, I was just crying. I mean, I cry in the scene anyway. But I was like, oh my God, for some reason, it's just given it so much more meaning. And I couldn't even explain why, but it just did it. It was almost just like the beat that I had to leave all of a sudden just fitted perfectly with the rest of the scene and how it was going. And it's just amazing. And it's so funny how little things like that can almost change the whole dynamic of what you're doing.
Yeah, but I think the audiences won't notice. They will, but they won't. They'll notice subconsciously, and they'll have an emotional reaction to it, but they won't know why they're feeling it, but they will unconsciously know it. And that, I think, that's what I think is beautiful about the conscious and unconscious mind, of why we, how we perceive things and how we get affected by things. And sometimes we just don't know what the actual reason is of why we're feeling it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's like us going back to saying when we would go back and analyse things that we've watched and go, well, why did that happen? And it's just being so interested in it, I guess, and just figuring out what in your mind is connected to that, and you know, was it something in specific or is it just a really good one.
Have you seen Memphis?
Yes, the musical.
So in the Broadway version, he sings the last final song, and it's the same thing. I'll send you the link afterwards, because I think it's just amazing. Everyone comes in and they're like, oh, we're going to grab some beers and stuff, and then he's like, no, I'll stay here. And then he turns to the audience and he puts his hand behind his back, and then the music set goes do, and then like the drum kicks in, and the drum goes, there's a town that I know, that song. And then he just does like a shudder of his body, and he goes, and he sings, and it's just so magical. But he's just literally just like hit ricocheted his body on the count of that drum. And I watch you honestly always, and I just go, why do I feel it? Because he's got the rhythm of the body in the rhythm of the music, and then he starts singing. I'm like, it's so simple that the simplicity is, but it takes such skill to do that. That's what I think is amazing.
Yeah.
When Ian McKellen does a massive speech, or when Judi Dench does something, or these brilliant actors, or Daniel Day-Lewis, and they do something so brilliant, but it's so small, and you're like, well, it's taken you 30 years to be able to do that really specific, small detail thing to make us feel a certain way.
Yeah, I love stuff like that, where, as you say, it can be something that's so simple, but it's just so effective.
Yeah.
And then you would try and do it yourself, and you can't do it, and you go, but it looks so easy.
I know. It's those sort of nuances. I remember it was Jerry Mitchell doing Kinky Boots, and a friend of mine's one of the associates on it, and I remember him telling me about the way they unveil the shoe. And he was like, there's a certain way that you do it, because the audience are either going to start clapping and go, whoa, or they're not. And it's a simple thing of taking it out of the box and presenting it. But there's a certain way that Jerry would do it, and there's a certain way that everyone else would do it. And Jerry would do it a certain way, because it's a very, very particular nuance and such a simplicity to it. And if you don't get it right, you don't get the same reaction. And everyone was like, you're just taking the shoe out of the box. And it's not just about taking the shoe out of the box, it's the way you do it and the simplicity of it. And I find that whenever you see creators really work, like Susan Stroman, or brilliant directors and on Broadway, or kind of Chris Nolan work, it's the small, small things that we kind of look at going, oh my God, it's tiny, but actually in the grand scheme of things, it's a massive, massive choice. So I think your thing...
I was saying the thing with you exiting
is a really small choice, but in a grand scheme of things, massive.
Yeah, no, it really is. And I mean, I'm trying to think. I don't think Words Fail gets a clap, because I'm trying to think. I mean, it's the thing, it feels like it's been so long since we've done this show. I don't think Words Fail gets a clap, because it moves so beautifully into the scene between Evan and Heidi. And I think I've got this right. But in rehearsal, I'm sure that I heard them saying, don't leave room for a clap to be there, because it's such a it's such a big moment that in a way I think actually a clap would have spoiled the atmosphere of what's just happened. Mm. But as I say, the way that they are able to then stage it so that it moves so beautifully into the next scene, it's almost like the audience feel it and they understand, oh, no, this isn't a time when we clap. As yeah. phenomenal as the song just was,
yeah.
now's not the time to let out like a roar of applause. You know, mm-hmm. save that for when he comes out for his bow. But...
Yeah, yeah. So
which is always wild.
So I want to kind of finalize this and go, we spoke about a lot of different things about mindfulness and the way that we interact with things. And I want to know, what would be your kind of quote that's always kind of stuck by you that you've either learned from when you're younger or it might be a previous thing that you kind of give to yourself or someone else?
I think for me, what has always stuck in my head when I do anything, you know, whether it's theatre related or not, is when my mum would say to me, all you can ever do is your best.
Mm.
You know, if you do your best, you've done what you needed to do. And I mean, she would say it about all sorts of things. Like, she would say it about like my GCSEs, or, and she'd go, so long as you try your best, that is all that you can do. You cannot do any more
mm.
than do your absolute best. And, you know, whatever the outcome is, just always be proud that you've done your best. So I think whenever I'm doing something, or if I'm approaching new work, or if I come out of an audition and you know, I feel a bit down about it, I just think, if I've given it my absolute best, that'll always be okay.
Mm.
So really, that's really just one. Always something that I stick by.
Really good one. Always just do your best, and then let the universe and the world, the other extremities of whatever kind of happens.
Exactly.
Let it happen.
Yeah. Because there's so much stuff that is actually out of our control.
Mm.
So long as we do our bit and we give 100% of what we can give,
mm.
that will always be enough, because yeah. you physically could not have done any more.
Yeah.
So that's just what I always remind myself. Just so long as you try your best, it'll always be okay.
Yeah. The only thing you can control is your own reactions. That's the only thing you control in the world.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And how you sort of take things in and how you react to something. Yeah,
exactly, that's it.
I agree.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for this brilliant chat. I'm in awe of you. I think you're just brilliant. I think I really am. I could chat
you.
I could literally chat for hours with you. I think you're so like insightful, and you're just like a little pocket of like lots of information that I didn't know about you before, and I'm that inquisitive to learn more about you now.
I mean, I always get so nervous with things like that. Like, I did a Q&A with a young drama school in Bath over Zoom. And I did say to them, I went, guys, I can talk for hours. I went, please stop me if I go off on a complete different route that is not even related to the question that you asked. But which I did do so many times, but everyone was like, no, we'll just sit and listen to you ramble. And
it's great though, because we get to know about more about you and how your brain works. And I think that's what's important, is to find out how the person works, not just the answers, but the way that you process things. That's the important thing for me.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I sit back, I mean, I'm sure I'll sit back and I'll listen to this and I'll go, how did I get to that when we were talking about this? And I think, what was my brain thinking of when it just suddenly hopped from one thing to the other?
I'm sure audiences and people are going to love whatever you've said in this, and they're really going to take a lot from it. And I know they're going to be really impacted by it and affected by it. So thank you so much.
Oh, hopefully. No, thank you for having a chat. I've loved it.
Thank you so much. This is 360 Yourself, and I'm Jamie Neal. Thank you very much for taking a moment to listen to our wonderful guests. Please subscribe to our podcast to access all our brilliant guest episodes. They are released every Sunday at 12 p.m. We are available on all listening platforms: Spotify, Pocket Casts, Overcast, Google Podcasts, and Castro. You can also find us on Instagram at 360_yourself, Twitter at yourself360, and our host at Jamie Neal JN. Thank you for listening.